loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Israel's killing of unarmed Palestinians has finally caught the attention of international organizations as the diplomatic fallout over deadly violence in Gaza gathers steam. Countries around the world have condemned the Israeli response to Palestinian demonstrations, and that criticism has moved into the United Nations. Next, the Senate Intelligence Committee today voted 10-5 to send the nomination of Gina Haspel to be CIA director to the floor for a final vote. All 8 Republicans and 2 Democrats voted yes on Haspel, who now has enough votes to guarantee confirmation. That final vote will likely take place in the next 48 hours. Then, testimony from the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the Trump Tower meeting between Trump campaign officials and lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya was released today. We'll take a look behind the headlines and discuss the real story. And then, primary elections were held yesterday in Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Nebraska, with women and progressives coming out on top in the Democratic Party and mainstream Republicans winning most of their nomination races. Pennsylvania was the most closely watched state. It saw 3 women win congressional nominations in districts that are likely to flip from red to blue. And Richard Saccone, who lost a closely watched race last month to Democrat Connor Lamb in southwestern Pennsylvania, lost again, this time to a mainstream Republican and veteran. And finally, the United States is pushing for a deal in negotiations on a revised North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. But Canadian and Mexican officials were not even scheduled to arrive in Washington before tomorrow's deadline. And without an agreement in writing, Congress can't begin to debate it in advance of passage. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Palestine. Israel's killing of unarmed Palestinians has finally caught the attention of international organizations as the diplomatic fallout over deadly violence in Gaza gathers steam. Countries around the world have condemned the Israeli response to Palestinian demonstrations, and that criticism has moved into the United Nations. We're joined from the West Bank by Ambassador Manuel Hassassian, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom. Always great to have you, Mr. Ambassador. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So can you tell us, Ambassador, diplomatically, what is the next move on this crisis?
Well, basically, you know, the options are very limited for us. The only option and the only recourse to redress, you know, the situation is basically to go to the international community and use every single means that we can diplomatically to show the world, you know, the naked aggression of Israel against innocent Palestinian civilians. The carnage, the total carnage today is almost 67, with 3,700 being injured. So the situation is precarious at best, and the leadership had decided to continue with its diplomatic onslaught to get recognition and to expose Israel's brutal aggression against the Palestinians at a time when Israel is commemorating its independence and the Americans are so happy in transferring their U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and in supporting the state of Israel in its act of violence against the Palestinians, and recognizing Jerusalem as the state, as the capital of Israel. I mean, putting all these things together, I think the region is now becoming more and more intense. I think, you know, the feelings of Muslims, Christians all over the world are inflamed. I think the chances of the peace process have been lost and undermined by the actions of the United States. And today, of course, Israel more than ever now is being scrutinized under the international lens for its, you know, human rights violations and the killings and maimings of Palestinians. So what we are witnessing is a dramatic change, you know, on the political scene. Things are getting more out of hand now, and the conflict is exacerbated by the continuous policies of Israel against, you know, the Palestinian people. And of course, you know, we have seen certain kinds of diplomatic gestures by the international community. I believe that 4 or 5 countries already has asked the Israeli ambassadors to leave. And we are witnessing more and more support coming from friendly countries. European countries have taken certain stand against, you know, Israel by criticizing its policies. We've seen also dramatic changes when it comes basically to bilateral relations between Israel and other European countries. So the situation is very tense in the Middle East, especially in the occupied territories. You know, now we are in the month of Ramadan, and the situation in Gaza is terrible. Under siege for 10 years and with no prospects of any kind of stability, let alone they lack food, supplements, medicine. And for the last 6 weeks, you have seen how many Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. So the situation there is terrible. It's beyond the subhuman level. And the leadership here is trying more or less through the ambassadors that we have all over the world to try more or less to be proactive in getting more support from the countries, from the host countries. And we're trying basically now to submit file suits against, Israel in the International Criminal Court. We're waiting for the general prosecutor, to give us the timing to submit that. Mm-hmm. Concerning the building of illegal settlements. And of course, the United Nations yesterday, we could not get a Security Council resolution on what is happening in Palestine because Israel's veto, as you know. U.S. veto, as you know. 14 countries, have been siding with us in the Security Council.
Let's talk about the Security Council a little bit. And also, I want to talk about what the U.S., what Nikki Haley did at the Security Council, John. And also, this amazing media coverage. I'm looking at the Washington Post editorial about what's happened.
Yes.
Hamas has launched another war. This is the Washington Post lead editorial. Hamas has launched another war. Israel needs a better response. John, let's talk about this with the ambassador.
Yes, and we should remind our listeners, too, we're speaking with Ambassador Manuel Hassassian. He's the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, and we're speaking with him from the West Bank. So he's there on the ground. Ambassador, Brian is right. At least in the U.S. press, it seems that they've chosen a side. It's not the side of the Palestinian people. And this is the narrative that the American people are being fed. Now, Nakba Day is not just a one single day that's commemorated and then everybody moves on. This has been a very profound demonstration and period of demonstrations. I can't imagine that the people of Gaza are just going to go back to their homes now and this is all over. How do you see this playing out in the coming weeks?
Well, let me tell you first, we are not surprised by the total media bias in the United States. But I should commend you for Sputnik, that at least you hear the other side and you gave us a fair representation of our narrative. Thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you.
However, we are not surprised at the mainstream media in the United States, being CNN, Fox News, Washington Post, and the entire media has always been hijacked by the Zionist propaganda in the United States. So we are not surprised to see such articles. Now, my question is, for the last 6 weeks, all these peaceful demonstrations, unarmed demonstrations, going to the borders between Israel and Gaza, it's a gesture by the Palestinian people of nonviolence. But they want the siege to break. They want it to be uplifted. They are living at the subhuman level. When is the international community listen to the victims rather than the victimizer? Every single organization in the United States, media and whatever, are supporting Israel's self-defense. Self-defense from whom? Show me one Israeli has been killed, in all these unfolding events. Show me one Israeli has been injured in all these unfolding events. The international community is witnessing on television the naked, brute aggression of the Israelis, killing indiscriminately women, children, old men, people who are going to express through nonviolence their dissatisfaction with the brute policies of Israel. How can the United States be so blind and not to see the naked truth of what Israel is all about? The United States has been on the wrong side of history. They have decided to be unequivocally a partner with Israel, with the occupier. How can they be basically an honest broker of peace when they totally side with Israel, when they veto every Security Council against Israel, when they are supporting Israel through the idea of self-defense, killing the Palestinians. When they celebrate the moving of their embassy, when they recognize the state of Palestine, the state, the Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, at the time when they are breaching all international laws, international conventions, it's unbelievable how the United States, that is spearheading the so-called freedom freedom of thought, democracy, and what have you, is siding with a brutal occupation and helping Israel militarily, politically, diplomatically, to control and subdue 6 million Palestinians living in the occupied territories. It is unreal. It is surreal to believe that the United States of America, the U.S. administration, that is supposed to play, you know, a fair deal, you know, between Palestinians and Israelis. For the last 24 years, we have seen nothing but procrastination. We have seen nothing but the building of settlements. We have seen nothing but the formation of an apartheid state of Israel against the Palestinians. All this under the eyes of the United States. And still, they visualize us, portray us as being terrorists, Hamas, and this and that, giving excuses that, you know, are not reasonable and they cannot really be comprehended. I can't believe how they think they can fool the world with such policies and with such media.
We are going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Ambassador Manuel Hassassian. He is the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, and he joined us today from the West Bank. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Senate Intelligence Committee today voted 10-5 to send the nomination of Gina Haspel to be CIA director to the floor for a final vote. All 8 Republicans and 2 Democrats voted yes on Haspel, who now has enough votes to guarantee confirmation. That final vote will likely take place in the next 48 hours. We're joined from New York by Jeremy Varon. He's a professor at the New School in New York City and an anti-torture activist. Jeremy, good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Jeremy, I'm gonna rant here, and this may not even be a question so much as a statement that I'd like to hear your reaction to. But one of the things that has really disgusted me about the end stages of this process in the Senate Select Committee were the statements of the ranking Democrat, Mark Warner. Mark Warner, in the very beginning of the process, professed to be the one person talking sense about Gina Haspel and demanding accountability. The kind of accountability that Gina Haspel has never faced. At the end of it, he released a statement, and this was just yesterday, saying essentially, well, the CIA workforce seems to really like her, and if that's who they want, then that's who they should have. But you can say of any horrible group, I mean, I don't want to compare Gina Haspel to a Nazi, but just for the sake of argument, you could ask any Nazi in 1945, who do you like the best? And they would tell you who they like the best. That doesn't make the person any less of a Nazi. Well, they wanted Gina Haspel, and now it looks like they're going to get Gina Haspel. What do you think?
It's a sad day for American democracy. This result wasn't unexpected, but I was hoping against hope that maybe she couldn't make it out of committee or would be rejected if the full Senate voted, but it looks like she's going to be appointed. And then the support by Senator Warner is deeply disappointing. I grew up in Virginia, Northern Virginia. My family were Democratic Party activists and knew him personally before when he was governor. And he seemed to have capitulated on this issue. Allegedly, she gave him private assurances that she thought the interrogation program never should have been started, but she failed to say that publicly. And, you know, one can't help but think that in Virginia, that's where the CIA is. There's a lot of CIA employees, and the demographics of his constituents at some level affected how he chose to vote. But that's speculation.
Ron Wyden, who is the senior senator from Oregon and a Democrat and also a senior member of the Intelligence Committee, tweeted this today. And he said it just very plainly and simply. He said, Gina Haspel and the CIA have committed one of the most blatant abuses of power in recent history, aided and abetted by a total failure of congressional oversight. It's about time somebody said something like that. But at the same time, Ron Wyden has not said that he will join Rand Paul's filibuster. Indeed, no Democrat has said that he or she would join Ron Paul's filibuster on the floor of the Senate. What do you make of that?
That there's, you know, limits to the political courage that our representatives are willing to show. This is the first I'm hearing of the filibuster prospect. I know that, you know, Wyden voted against Haspel in the committee, and that would be a bold move for Paul to try to filibuster, and that would really force the hand of the Democrats to show how committed they are to opposing Haspel's nomination.
Yeah, let me actually read Ron Wyden's statement. He issued this today on his official congressional website. He says here, Gina Haspel and the CIA have committed one of the most blatant abuses of power in recent history, aided and abetted by a total failure of congressional oversight. I have asked again and again for some justification for Ms. Haspel's self-serving classification decisions, and every response I have received in classified and unclassified settings has convinced me further that those decisions have nothing to do with protecting sources and methods and only to do with protecting her own image. I have very grave concerns about Ms. Haspel, and I believe her background makes her unsuitable to be CIA director. My concerns are wide-ranging and are based on still classified matters that are far broader than what has been reported in the press. They are not just historical, but they involve what kind of leader she is and will be going forward if she is confirmed. It doesn't get any stronger than that. It doesn't get any more clear than that. But he's the only Democrat saying this kind of thing. Sure, there were four other Democrats who voted no. There were four other Democrats that asked tough questions of Haspel in this hearing. But nobody else is coming out and saying she's unsuitable. She's unfit to be CIA director. Why is that?
Well, Senator McCain, he's a Republican, but he did say that her failure to declare torture immoral was disqualifying. That's his exact word, and I think it's very appropriate. I mean, one can, you know, spend a lifetime being disappointed by the failure of nerve of the Democrats. And, you know, they make political calculations about what it's worth spending political capital on. And then, you know, people have said a lot of critical things of her, and I don't, gainsay that. But it appears that they know in raw political terms that they're going to lose this fight, and a kind of resignation has set in. And then going back to Wyden's comment, something important to underscore is that Haspel's record was never in any meaningful way made public. So in the hearings, when she was being vetted, nothing about her past could be stipulated as fact because her entire career as a clandestine operation officer is secret. And then she had claimed the sole authority to declassify bits of her tenure at the CIA. So it was a surreal setting in which people are talking around her possible complicity in torture, but nothing definitive about her career, where she served, under whom, in what capacity, what she saw and what she did, could even be discussed publicly. So the whole thing felt like a charade, an empty ritual in a kind of pseudo-vetting and pseudo-democratic, you know, deliberation. But here they're trying to nominate somebody who holds, you know, the key to the, you know, chamber of just what her career entailed. So it was, you know, a sort of meaningless exercise.
It feels like a farce, actually. I mean, John, you wrote the article in the Washington Post, your op-ed, which I still really, really encourage everybody to read. And people can find it on, just look on the internet. I went to prison for disclosing the CIA's torture. Gina Haspel helped cover it up. By you, John Kiriakou, because you exposed it and you went to prison. Now, let's think back. It was the Obama administration that went after you after Bush couldn't prosecute you. They sent you to prison. At the same time, Obama said, let's move forward about the issue of torture.
Yes.
He said, we're not going to do it anymore. We tortured some folks. We're going to move forward, though, meaning no one would be held accountable like Gina Haspel. And so then, because we move forward, the next president comes in and says, well, yeah, let's not just move forward. Let's take Gina Haspel, the torturer, the person who's connected to all the torture, and make her in charge. Make her in charge. And here you have the Democrats then saying, well, we don't know enough. The CIA employees, they want her. Some mealy-mouthed reason. So here we have this farce repeating itself over and over and over again.
It's that moral relativism that bothers me the most, because the Democrats have chosen to ignore the bigger picture. The bigger picture is that crimes were committed. Gina Haspel committed crimes. Crimes against humanity, possibly. War crimes, possibly. Certainly obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, even destruction of a federal record, which, believe it or not, is a felony in this country. And she's never been called to task for any of these things that she's done. And indeed, and I say this in the Washington Post piece, the message is that you can go ahead and commit these crimes and you can still get promoted. And indeed, you can even become the director.
As long as you don't blow the whistle on any of these crimes.
That's right.
Anyway, Jeremy, it seems so incredible. It's so disgusting. And yet it's the reality of American politics. And again, it's a bipartisan affair, really.
Right. I mean, and I've done a lot of thinking about how we got to this point of, you know, pretty much total immunity for torture. And I think the two fateful moments were, first, the original drafting of the torture memos. Essentially, the CIA wanted to torture detainees. It asked the White House to tell the Justice Department to make torture legal. And through legal sophistry and bad legal arguments, John Yoo and Jay Bybee did the unthinkable, which was to give torture, you know, the color of legality. And then the CIA, for a couple of years at least, operated under the color and cover of what was, according to the Justice Department, lawful. And they could plausibly claim, even though they're committing the criminal acts of torture, that had been decriminalized by the Justice Department. So that was the first fateful moment in which torture had the color and cover of the law. And then when Obama came into office, he essentially said that any CIA agent or other interrogator who was operating under the broad framework of the torture memo couldn't be held legally accountable. And as an anti-torture activist, seeing this happen, I knew it was going to come back to bite this country. And it bit hard over this last week, where somebody deeply complicit in torture can say with some, you know, shred of superficial credibility, it wasn't illegal, because George Bush administration had essentially made it legal, and Obama had condoned that absurd manipulation of the law. And no, there has been no accounting for that within the legal system and within the broader American political discourse.
And that's really a debate that we have not had in this country, the legality of this program. Just because the George W. Bush Justice Department said it was legal doesn't mean that it was legal. That's not been decided in the courts, you know, since 1980, really. But we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We were joined from New York by Jeremy Varon. Jeremy's a professor at the New School in New York City, and he's an anti-torture activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Testimony from the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the Trump Tower meeting between Trump campaign officials and lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya were released today. We'll take a look behind the headlines and discuss the real story. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim, always good to have you.
Thanks, guys.
So tell us why this is important. The Senate Judiciary Committee released these transcripts today, and they're very long, very detailed and involved transcripts. But why are they important?
Well, I don't know exactly what the importance of all of these things are. I read all of the testimony of Natalia Veselitskaya. I hope I got that right. And it's clear to me that she came into this with an agenda that was very different from the one that's being promoted here, and that was promoted to the Trumps by this guy, Rob Goldstone. She is obsessively focused on the Browder-Magnitsky issue. Her client, she came in as the lawyer for a client, another Russian capitalist. They call them oligarchs for some reason there, and it's fine by me. These are capitalists whose property was under threat of seizure by Browder. So she was, as a lawyer, representing her client, but she also is obviously extremely obsessed with this issue. As I hate to say it, I understand this because I got involved in looking at this myself a couple of months ago. And this Browder-Magnitsky thing, I think, is one of the biggest cons ever pulled on anybody. And she comes into this, and all of her answers that aren't, no, I don't know, I don't know, you know, do you know, have you ever met Donald Trump? No. Have you met Vladimir Putin? No. Do you know this guy? No. Do you know this guy? No. All substantive answers of her, she turns right away into a lengthy disquisition about this Browder case and how horrible it was that this guy pulled the wool over the American Congress and got these laws passed that created the new Cold War with Russia. So she's obsessively focused on that. And it's clear to me she came into this meeting thinking she was going to have an opportunity to present this case to a prominent son of a prominent businessman who might help her get it out to the American public or the American Congress again. And that Goldstone promoted this case to the Trump campaign as this woman's coming in with dirt on Hillary Clinton. She knows nothing about Hillary Clinton. She's completely flummoxed by this. So it's clear to me that there were two completely different agendas going into this meeting. One was hers as the lawyer for her client in this Magnitsky-Browder affair, and as someone who wanted to persuade the Congress, I want to be able to tell them how they got fooled by this guy Browder. And the other was whatever Goldstone was telling the Trump campaign. She didn't know who she was sitting with. The only person she was introduced to, she says, was Trump Jr. The other two guys, Manafort and Kushner, she didn't know who they were. They weren't even introduced. She didn't know who they were until months, she saw them on TV later. And it was quite clear to her that, after a 20-minute, maybe max 30-minute meeting with translation, that they were absolutely uninterested in what she had to say. I've seen quotes now from them saying, why are we sitting there listening to this thing about this Browder business? They had no, the Trump campaign had no interest in this. And the Trump campaign was sold a bill of goods by Goldstone. And she was, they asked her all these questions, did you work for the Russian government? She was working for the prosecutor's office in 2000, for 3 years in early 2000s, but she was not a paid, she was working here for a private client. She didn't know Putin. She didn't know this. She didn't know that. What do you know about Facebook? I don't know anything about Facebook. Questions. Most of the questions, she's simply saying, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. And the minute she gets the chance to say something substantive, it's all about the Browder case. I'm saying, and as someone who's looked into this Browder case a few months ago and got obsessed with it myself, it's like the Kennedy assassination. If you ask somebody who's interested in the Kennedy assassination, how was your trip to Dallas? They're going to start talking to you about the Kennedy assassination. And here it was clear that they were asking her all kinds of things she had no idea about. But the minute they got, what were you talking about? Or what did you come here for? Well, this was my issue. And she goes into a lengthy thing with details.
Jim, let me jump in, because she was meeting with all kinds of people in Washington. She met with congresspeople of both Republicans and Democrats about the Magnitsky Act. Now, the Magnitsky Act is based on the death of an imprisoned Russian either lawyer or accountant, depending on whose version you are listening to, about American hedge fund manager Bill Browder began pushing Congress to sanction Moscow for an alleged human rights violation. Moscow has a whole different story about what actually happened, and they say that Browder was, in fact, involved in criminal sort of covering up or tax evasion or whatever. Anyway, doesn't matter. The Obama administration and Hillary Clinton opposed the Magnitsky Act in the first years of the Obama administration after Browder was trying to do this. Obama did not want to pass it. He opposed the Magnitsky Act. He opposed these sanctions. So did Hillary Clinton. And around 2010, around 2011, the same time this was becoming an issue in Congress, Bill Clinton was offered to speak, I believe, on behalf of the Clinton Foundation in Russia at the time that Hillary Clinton and Obama was opposing the Magnitsky Act. And I think Clinton got $500,000 in speaking fees on behalf of the Clinton Foundation. Now, some people made the argument later that this was a pay-for-play, give the Clinton Foundation money, and Clinton or Obama were opposing the Magnitsky Act. Later, Obama and Hillary Clinton switched their position on the Magnitsky Act, and after Congress passed it, Obama signed it into law. But that was partly a quid pro quo, because Obama, representing or sort of seeking to represent some interest in Silicon Valley, who wanted a different sanctions bill against Russia to be lifted so that they could sell high tech to Russia. That was the quid pro quo in Congress, I believe, at that time, was Obama would support the Magnitsky Act, but Congress would go along and lift sanctions that would be impacting Silicon Valley. Anyway, that's another part of the story, none of which would come out, none of which seemed even sinister. It's kind of the way you do business. Lobbyists try to influence political leaders or government leaders. They have lots of money. They have speaking engagements. They get extraordinary speaking fees. It's pay to play. This was before Russia became completely sinister.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And this is, she was, I think, very naive about thinking what she could do. With
Natalia, you're talking now about the Russian lawyer.
Without a doubt. She just didn't understand the system.
Yeah, and afterwards she's going, all of a sudden I'm seeing these versions of what I was involved with that have nothing to do with what I was doing. And, but it's very hard to communicate this. Because this Browder and Magnitsky business is complicated. There was a guy who made a Russian anti-Putin guy who made a film about Browder and went into it saying, oh, Browder, Magnitsky's a terrible star. I'm going to make a film with you. And the film was, he tried to show it in Washington and they kind of almost refused him. It's very hard to get. I happen to get a link to it.
I interviewed him for an hour, by the way, on this show back when he was shut down, Browder and his allies made sure that people would not see that movie in Europe or here.
Browder's been he really is a great con man, and he mobilized the entire political media apparatus to prevent himself from being judicially scrutinized for tax evasion. And this guy Nekrasov, as you know, then started to make this film on behalf of Browder and started to discover Browder was a liar and a con man. And it's a very interesting film to watch. Anyway, nobody's going to get into this. This is too complicated. It's a rat's nest of complicated, financial dealings. So they've made this story that this woman, Natalia, was coming in to give dirt about Hillary Clinton. And she knows nothing about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, so Rob Goldstone, the music producer, said she has dirt on Hillary Clinton, meaning dirt on Hillary Clinton and the Clintons getting money from Russians. So Donald Trump wrote back, I love it. And that's why Trump allowed the meeting to happen, but she had a different agenda. That's what you're saying, basically.
That's, a totally different agenda. It was all focused on the Browder Magnitsky thing. The minute she sat down and began talking, they were going, what are we listening to here? Has nothing to do. Do you have anything else to tell us? No. So thank you very much for coming here. We'll see what we can do for you, meaning for this Browder issue. And so everything that's said about, oh, we're going to help you with your issue is the Browder issue. But, she knew very well that going out that after it was over that they didn't really care what she was talking about. And she had no dirt on anybody. And she didn't give a darn about the American political campaign.
And then when the emails came out, Donald Trump Jr. and maybe with the help of his father, they put out their own press release about the meeting saying it was all about adoptions or something like that. And of course, Russia stopped Americans from adopting Russian kids following the passage of the Magnitsky Act. Anyway, everybody had their own little agenda and covering up their agenda, except it seems Natalia, who had a straightforward agenda, which was to represent her client who was being targeted because of the Magnitsky Act.
That's correct. That's the way I read it. And as afterwards, now the press and the politicians and the anti-Trump politicians and the anti-Putin politicians have the agenda of turning this into a crucial node in the conspiracy between Putin and Trump, which is silly.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, Jim. We were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Primary elections were held yesterday in Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Nebraska, with women and progressives coming out on top in the Democratic Party and mainstream Republicans winning most of their nomination races. Pennsylvania was the most closely watched state. It saw three women win congressional nominations in districts that are likely to flip from red to blue. And Richard Saccone, who lost a closely watched race last month to Connor Lamb in southwestern Pennsylvania, lost again, this time to a mainstream Republican and veteran. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor at Progressive Army, and she's the host of the show The Way with Anoa. Anoa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Anoa, even though there were multiple states that had primaries yesterday, the real story is Pennsylvania. And the real story in that story is in the House races across the state of Pennsylvania. Now, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court a few months ago mandated the redrawing of those House district boundaries. And the new boundaries are far more favorable to Democrats than they had been with the old boundaries. Democrats are saying that they could even win as many as 5 total seats. Do you think that these nominations show the Democrats in Pennsylvania on the right track to that goal?
I think these nominations show that there are people, there are progressives, there are actors, there are folks who are tired of the status quo who are ready to change course. Democrats, because, you know, when you have strong progressive candidates, particularly the four from DSA who ran and won, you know, primaries last night, they're able to claim these as victories because we're running on their ballot line, right? So in that instance, I guess, yes, Democrats are on the right track. And when we really start parsing it out and seeing why, just as we saw, you know, some of the efforts in Virginia, I mean, we're seeing this all over. We're seeing that when progressives are able to invest and support good candidates who are committed to doing good work, they're able to get on the ground and really build that support and traction, that they can win. Democrats, unfortunately, you know, the mainstream hardline Dems will continue to double down on the same nonsense that they have been, that may work for certain folks like a Nancy Pelosi type or others, you know, who may be locally in Pennsylvania who have certain entrenched, you know, power already within the machine. But for the most part, if we're really serious about changing course and moving, you know, getting traction on issues, Pennsylvania is a state that has had its share of legislation passed regarding, abortion and so many other things. I want to say Pennsylvania might have been in one of the states that had a Blue Lives Matter law proposed. Don't quote me on that. That's off the top of my head, so I could be wrong. But, I mean, there are all these considerations, and we're really thinking about taking back these state houses, which should be a priority right now, right? Not still arguing about Trump and Twitter. I mean, it's going to be looking at these races and these organizations like your DSAs, like your Our Revolutions, like the various grassroots, you know, shops that have popped up to support these types of candidates running across the board. So, I mean, are Democrats on the right track? They are, if they let the grassroots and progressives do what they do best.
And that's exactly the debate. I'm looking at a piece at 538.com. It's a site that I like, I respect, I read it all the time. They have a very interesting/odd headline related to these primaries. And the headline is, did Democrats just have their first Tea Party moment of the 2018 primaries? So they're saying essentially what you're saying, Anoa, that it was progressives who really grabbed this election by the horns and ran with it. They were well-funded. They didn't back down against mainstream Democrats, and they won. But 538.com is saying that this isn't necessarily a good thing, because it is these Democrats who, because they're likely to win, are going to be more ready, more demanding of challenging Republicans in the House of Representatives rather than sitting across the negotiating table and working with them. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing, Anoa?
I mean, you know, 538 every once in a while, you know, has some stuff that I like as well. But for the most part, I really do find that there is a commitment to maintaining the status quo in American politics.
Yep.
And we see that across so many of these sites. Like, you know, every once in a while, we'll see a good op-ed in the Washington Post, you know, New York Times, you know, we'll see some good content, something that resonates. But at the same time, ultimately, these outlets, and 538, we saw this particular 2016 election, is really committed to maintaining a particular train of thought and process and line of thinking. I mean, we're facing that down here in Georgia as well, you know. So I think that we need people who are going to challenge and not just roll over. We need to inspire people because there's a lot at stake here, right? We're building for the long term and not just looking at this, you know, election by election, but really thinking about how do we change the landscape politically in this country for the long haul. And to do so, it's going to take taking leaps of faith like this, like on the candidates who won from DSA. I am a proud newer member of DSA, my chapter down here in Atlanta. But I really feel like when we start developing and nurturing candidates and providing the base of support, not only for them to run and win, but also for them when they're governing and participating in that process of governance and representation, because that's the thing. It doesn't stop when we elect these candidates. We still need to stay involved and engage and provide them with the support to do what they're doing. Because just like we see right now, the Senate on the verge to take up the issue of net neutrality, that wasn't just because we had some Democrats who knew how to talk to the Republicans across the aisle and get something going. That's been a people-driven process demanding that our senators actually take this seriously, demanding that Congress take this up and protect the American people. So we see this happening, and for whatever reason, whether it's just because of the donor class or whatever the case may be, Democrats are very reluctant to do what it takes to be good stewards of democracy, versus just doing what is enough for them to hold up post and keep a job. And that's a real problem. So I disagree with that assessment. I think it is actually a very good thing that we have people who are going to be there to challenge, but they're going to challenge with clear facts and be able to actually communicate with people about what is going on and why we need you engaged and involved. Because that's part of why we are in the mess that we've been in the past 20 or so years as a democracy, is the fact that people got complacent and are not involved in the political process itself. Now, I appreciate all my brother and sister comrades, activists out there who, you know, electoral politics is not the way to liberation. That's totally true. But at the same time, we can't keep continuing to cede ground electorally to these other people to make decisions for our lives at the most basic levels of government, all the way up until the presidency and Congress, right? And so I feel like, you know, when you have folks like what you reported from, you know, what you're reading to me from 538, it just reinforces a particular narrative and reinforces a particular order of operations, so to speak, and keeps people in their place, because they don't want a bunch of citizens starting to storm their state capitals and really starting to get involved with politics, because then the emperor has no clothes on and everything's out the bag, so to speak.
Anoa Changa is our guest. We're talking about the primary results from yesterday. I think, John, what Anoa is saying is so important, and so many different levels in electoral politics, outside of electoral politics, where it all comes together. What's the content? What's the progressive content?
And that's it.
And that's absolutely it. I can remember vividly 22 years ago at the beginning of Bill Clinton's 1996 re-election campaign. There was an event in New York. And a number of us who are grassroots activists actually kind of infiltrated the event. There was about 30 of us. And the point that we wanted to make was that Bill Clinton had just, quote, ended welfare as we know it,
right?
Something Ronald Reagan wanted to do, but Clinton actually did it. And the Democrats went along with it because he was a Democrat. 7 million children ripped off of AFDC rolls in one day. And we went in and we disrupted the heck out of it. And there were a lot of people who had been kicked off of welfare and a lot of people who were now in so-called workfare, which was just kind of a semi-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
We were all there. We disrupted it. And the Democrats went nuts against us because they said, you're helping the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole point was, you've adopted the Republican program. What difference does it matter? In fact, it might be worse, because if the Republicans had tried to do what Clinton did, people would be in the streets. And in fact, they weren't in the streets.
They weren't in the streets. And that's why I think these primaries are so important right now. TalkingPointsMemo.com, which is another terrific site for political analysis, makes a point that most of the Democrats who won, especially in Pennsylvania, are Democrats that support two things, right? They agree on these two things all the way across the state: universal Medicare and legalization of marijuana. And I think that what we're seeing, and this is the very beginning of it, I think we're seeing national Democrats returning to their progressive roots. And I think people have had enough of this dalliance with the center, which isn't really the center, it's the right. And they're going back to the left where they originally had been. And now we've got about a minute left. Why don't you close us out?
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Like, you know, people are acting like, oh, my God, it's to the radical left. And a lot of what's being called radical isn't even radical, right? It wasn't radical in the 30s with FDR. Certainly now in 2018, it's definitely not radical. A lot of what we're talking about is just basic common sense. It's really supported by the majority of American people. And we're looking at, you know, how do we branch? How do we build across a working, you know, populace on issues that are actually mattering to our communities, as well as having, you know, a lens of equity that's bent towards justice? So that's what we're looking at. And for those who work on the inside of the party, that's what they're trying to push the party back towards, bringing some balance to the force, so to speak. And for those who continue to stay outside of the party, they're doing the same thing. Everyone has their own space and place. And I'm looking forward to seeing what we continue to build and do. So thank you guys for having this space to have this conversation today.
Oh, you bet. And this is something that we're going to keep watching. We're so early in the process. There are so many other states where these same fights are going to be playing out in front of us, and not just in traditionally blue areas. We're not talking just about New England, let's say, or California. This is happening all over America. We're going to come back to you at some point too, Anoa, because we want to talk about Georgia. You know, so many experts are saying that under the radar right now, Georgia is very slowly starting to turn purple, as is Texas. And so there are a lot of races there, both in Georgia and Texas, that I think are going to be early indicators of where our politics are going in this country. So we'll end it there. We were joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army. And she's also the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The United States is pushing for a deal in negotiations on a revised North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. But Canadian and Mexican officials were not even scheduled to arrive in Washington before tomorrow's deadline. And without an agreement in writing, Congress can't begin to debate it in advance of passage. We're joined from New York by Pete Dolek. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro. He focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's also the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. Pete, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Pete, it seems like we have a serious disconnect here in Washington. What we've got is Donald Trump saying that tomorrow is the deadline for the renegotiation of NAFTA. And then you have the foreign ministers of Mexico and Canada both releasing statements today saying, we're not going to Washington. So where does this take us now? I mean, Donald Trump wants to renegotiate this thing, and he's been so loud and public about his insistence that it be negotiated. And the Mexicans and the Canadians pretty much like the deal the way it is. So what next?
Well, I guess it's all a big wild card right now. I mean, Trump's repeatedly threatened he would just pull completely out of NAFTA if he doesn't get his way. I'm not so sure he would really want to do that, and because, of course, he would get immense pressure and pushback against trying to do that by his true multinational corporate and billionaire base. Also, there is a kind of people in Congress who believe, well, Trump doesn't have the power to unilaterally withdraw, that it would need congressional approval. So everything is really up in the air. As you said, a disconnect is definitely the word for what's going on here, because the U.S. government, particularly the Office of the Trade Representative, has put on a really happy face about this for weeks steady now, saying, yes, we're really close, we're making wonderful progress. The Canadian government is saying somewhat similar things. They're being a little more cautious, but generally have put forth a sunny face on this as well. Whereas the Mexican government has been pretty consistent over the last 2 weeks of saying, you know, folks, we're not anywhere near a deal. And it seems like if somebody's telling the truth in here, I think it's the Mexican government, because there are several outstanding issues, and it doesn't seem that there's been much movement on those.
Well, that's a very important point. The Mexican foreign minister said yesterday that the problem is, quote unquote, philosophical differences. But the important part of that is that these philosophical differences are so serious and so fundamental that he's saying it's just impossible to have a deal negotiated by tomorrow. And tomorrow is the date that Paul Ryan chose, because he says that a deal needs to be done in order for him to put it on the fast track in the House of Representatives for it to be debated. That's just not going to happen. I will say that the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the U.S. and the Mexican side reached an accord on auto rules, but other issues like dispute settlement, arbitration systems, several other things, sunset provisions, they have no agreement on whatsoever.
No, they don't. There's also pharmaceuticals have come into the picture. Doesn't seem to be much movement on that. And Canadian dairy policy has also been an ongoing policy clash, and that's one area where Canada seems to be rather accommodating to the U.S. demands, but the exception to that seems to be on dairy, where the dairy industry is quite strong in Canada, and there's a lot of pushback there on Trudeau not to give in on that, and that seems to be an area where the U.S. In particular wants concessions from the Canadians, and they don't seem forthcoming.
Dairy, lumber, and shellfish, and as silly as it might sound, these are actually very serious trade issues. I'll tell you, when I was briefly assigned to the State Department, I spent 2 years at the State Department, I spent more time working on shellfish issues as it related to Canada than anything else. And it's because of this fundamental disagreement in definition that NAFTA never really took care of. And it's come up again in these negotiations, where the United States has declared clams to be a fish rather than a shellfish. And They say that it's a fish. I know this sounds hilarious, but it's actually pretty serious. They say that it's a fish because it actually moves more than shellfish do on the bottom of the ocean. The point being, if it's a fish, you can harvest it only in your territorial waters. And so the Canadians say, no, it's a shellfish. It just sits on the bottom of the ocean, so that the Canadians then can move into U.S. territorial waters and collect clams, right? Doesn't sound like a big deal. In fact, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And this is yet another one of these issues that the public doesn't really focus on that's very important that could torpedo this deal at the outset.
That's very interesting. I had not realized that detail, but it really, you're bringing it up really shows how really seriously detailed all of this is.
Yeah, this is very complicated, right? You can't just have a guy in the White House just say, we need to renegotiate this deal and it's got to be done by Thursday. That's not how this works. This took years to negotiate, and it's going to take years to renegotiate if all three sides want to renegotiate it.
Right, and it's not at all clear that all three sides want to renegotiate. I think Mexico seems to be the most reluctant, and I don't think Canada really particularly wants to renegotiate either, but they're willing to go through with it to some extent. But, you know, even though Trudeau is very accommodating toward Trump, you know, he has political pressures on him. He has limits on what he can do. And, of course, another consideration is the Mexican national elections are coming up on July 1st, and there you have a left-wing candidate who seems to be the persistent favorite there, who said, you know, it's not going to be on board with just making lots of concessions to the U.S. That's going to throw a monkey wrench in everything, too. That's another consideration why they're really trying to hurry this up as fast as they can. And, of course, they're also worried about the Democrats retaking the House of Representatives. That would also add still more complications to this. So there's a whole lot of moving parts that somehow will have to align, and it doesn't seem apparent that they're going to align.
You know, that's an important point, Brian, is U.S. elections coming up. I think that the White House is scrambling to get this done so that they can try and push it through a Republican Congress, or at least a Republican House of Representatives, rather than to have to then renegotiate everything with the Democrats.
Yep. And Pete, let's help the audience understand some of these terms and also some of the dynamics at play here. The U.S. trade deficit with Canada and with Mexico is growing. It increased, I think, with Mexico by about 12% in the last year. Now, Donald Trump's argument is that a trade deficit whereby the U.S. imports more from Mexico than Mexico imports from the United States is an indication that the United States is being treated badly, that it's a bad deal. But I want to just ask you about how some of these sort of definitions actually play out in real life, because take car production. When NAFTA went into effect in January 1994, there was also the phenomena following that of many U.S. car companies and other car companies going to Mexico, setting up shop, paying workers their lower wages. These are Western, and in this case, I'm talking about U.S. corporations. If they sell a car back to the United States, the car is coming from Mexico, but it's actually produced by a U.S. car manufacturer, no?
That's absolutely correct. You've just hit on a really important part, and this also actually applies to the trade deficit with China as well, but we'll leave that to another day. It's not Mexico doesn't take jobs from the U.S. It's U.S.-based corporations that move jobs to Mexico because they're taking advantage of the extremely low wages there to fatten their profits, which, of course, are at the expense of U.S. and Canadian workers there. So, yes, that counts as a trade deficit for the U.S. and a trade surplus for Mexico, but it's actually U.S. capital and not the Mexican government and certainly not the Mexican nation that's benefiting from that so-called surplus deficit ratio there. So the whole concept of well, we're getting a bad deal because we're running a trade deficit, it's very simplistic nonsense by somebody who frankly doesn't have the intellectual capability to really grasp what's going on here, and he's obviously have a lot more nationalists on there who are whispering in his ear and telling him what he wants to hear. So, you know, there's going to be trade across these borders. I mean, the U.S., Canada, Mexico are neighbors. There's going to be trade. The question is on what basis is the trade going to be and who's going to benefit from this trade. And at the end of the day, these trade deals like the NAFTA and the TPP, et cetera, they're really not about trade. They're really, really about ways for corporations, multinational capital, to knock down laws and rules and regulations that they don't like and increase their profits and eliminate barriers to their being able to profit at any cost, at any human or environmental or health cost. And that's why all the rules on here really have to do with you know, allowing corporations to sue governments because they don't like a rule and all these sorts of things, and that it goes to these secret tribunals. It's not really that much about trade because there's going to be trade. Again, it comes down to, well, who's benefiting from this?
You know, that's true, really. That's true. We talk about all these details, and the truth is that we're so integrated into each other's economies that details are not, and we're going to have to come to some sort of agreement because otherwise none of our economies are going to be able to handle an agreement like this, a long-term agreement like this, just sort of falling by the wayside.
And I think one of the reasons a lot of people, both in Mexico and in Canada and in the United States, working people opposed NAFTA was, one, working people were not at the table, really. There weren't workers' organizations, and unions were just meagerly consulted. And all of the agreements are really designed, as Pete is saying, to benefit the corporate elites in all three countries. And as a consequence, there's a lot of skepticism about NAFTA. People don't know what it is. But it would seem to me that in many ways, the deal is a bad deal for workers in all three countries. Again, if we look at economy just in an aggregate way without looking at the different social and class groupings that benefit, maybe we don't learn that much.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Pete Dolak. Pete's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro. He focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's also the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.